This is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
I'm Chris Palmer.
And I'm Mike Beats.
He always forgets. And this week, or this every other week, because we haven't done it for a couple of weeks, we want to talk about a bunch of things. I don't know how much we're going to get to, but one of the things that is on our minds is tournaments. And the idea that tournaments over time change. And sometimes they become unpopular, or sometimes they get popular, or sometimes people are just trying to start a tournament, and how do you make a tournament something that people want to come to? And so we're going to address those issues. And we've been talking a little bit about a tournament that just took place, and everybody says I shouldn't talk about what tournament it is, but obviously I'm going to. And this is the Manchester tournament that just took place in Massachusetts. Now, and the issue with the Manchester tournament is that this used to be a very popular tournament 10, 15 years ago when I first started in the activity. And the numbers are just are not there at the moment. So the question we have, the question we want to pose to ourselves and maybe anyone who's listening is, how do you turn around a tournament that is, you know, this is a school that is active in forensics and has been active in forensics all this time. So there's an internal support system. How do we get people back to this tournament? And this is, and I think the specific case makes it more understandable if we talk about it from there. So, go.
Okay, well, I think that we should emphasize that this is something that is really applicable to any kind of tournament that has had several years where perhaps it's shrunk and whatnot. And I say that from personal experience. The tournament that I run at Bronx Science, which had about 170, 180 LDers registered this year, the year before I came had 24 people in the LD field.
Well, let me interject. I will agree, because I watched this tournament back in the 94, 95. It was about 120 was the number that Sadako used to run it at. It was a little over 100. And I was there at the 100, little over 100, down to the handful, and up to the 180. So you have been in this position yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you were trying to, you had your solution to that, and I think it's going to be interesting to talk about that.
Right.
As well.
And I actually don't think that this is a case of one size fits all, because I don't think that every tournament needs to have 180 LDers or whatever number, right? I do think that tournaments, and I'm going to actually borrow Jim's expression from his blog, because I'll tell you the expression I used before this, but I think Jim's is actually better. Jim calls this branding the tournament, and I actually very strongly agree with that. I would say that the previous term I used was that every tournament needs to find its niche and address the niche, but I think branding the tournament is an even better way to think about it. I think that tournaments are successful when they transcend themselves, and what I mean by that is that tournaments are successful when they become an event, something that people want to go to because they want to be at that specific event, not because they want to get some rounds in on that weekend. I think that until you reach the point where your tournament feels like an event of any size, it could be an event of 12, an event of 212, you're not going to have a consistent following the way that a consistently successful tournament will. And that's something that I hope to talk about a little bit over the hour. But again, I want to emphasize that, three out of the four of us have been to the Manchester tournament before, and this is not like a dig on Manchester. The idea here is that we want to emphasize things that you can do, that anyone can do to build their tournament, especially after having years of a smaller turnout.
Well, actually, I mean, the situation between Manchester and the Bronx is virtually identical in that both of them had high TOC bid levels. Over time, those TOC bids disappeared. And the question becomes, people to travel to a tournament, is it warranted for me to spend a lot of money to go to a tournament just for that tournament itself. Now, the answer is not automatically no, but there are factors that get drawn in. So I have tournaments nearby, I have tournaments far away. I go to a tournament every week, or I send people to tournaments every week. So expense is predicated on bang for the buck to some extent. So traveling, I have to have a good reason to travel.
I also want to say something that Chris said before we started recording, which is that in many ways, it's actually harder to revive a tournament than to build a tournament, right? Like it's harder to start it's harder to revitalize a tournament than it is to start a new tournament, because when you revitalize a tournament, you're stuck with the baggage of the tournament, right? Like good and bad. You have that baggage. And so it can be very difficult to revive it. And actually Chris, as far as I'm concerned, has been the master of reviving and building tournaments as well, because he's done a lot of work at college tournaments that had in our area, perhaps not very strong reputations. And really, really turned those tournaments around, which I think is important.
Yeah, in particular, one of the challenges of the college tournaments used to be, and to some degree still is, you know, when I started running Yale, particularly on the speech side, not so much as on the debate side, there were a lot of the strong programs in the region that you want to attract to a tournament like Yale that after the tournament completely fell apart and was a complete utter disaster in 1997, had just said to themselves, I am never coming back to this tournament again. And to overcome that sort of self-promise that coaches make that they're never going to live through that horrendous experience they remember is why tournaments that have existed for a long time but kind of fallen on their heels have a much harder time establishing themselves, because they have to be responsible and they have to do enough to overcome the horrible memories of sitting there at 2 a.m. when there's no pairings up or whatever that the coaches went through.
But a lot of what was going on at the colleges was based on the fact that they just didn't have people who really knew how to tab. You know, so, I mean, you're not going to change the nature of the college tournaments as much as you're going to change the efficiency of the machine to run the college tournaments. I mean, they're still going to have all their activities. I mean, everything that Yale had in 1994... is pretty much what they have today. I mean, what it is that now it gets run because we have professional people who run the operation. You know, whereas if you take something like smaller tournaments have the, or starting a tournament or changing a tournament, you don't offer everything. I mean, you don't have speech and you don't have policy. You can't have all of them. So you have to sort of pick and choose.
Well, to some degree, though, that's not exactly true, because I think the other salient bit behind what at least I've brought to colleges is the other thing that drove people away was always the profiteering. And to a certain degree, I feel like this is also a problem that some tournaments that have fallen on bad times in high school world can suffer from. Because if you have a tournament like Manchester or the Bronx when it was suffering or whatever, and for years what people do is when they pick their, they set up their next year's tournament, they take their invitation and they look at their reg fees and they figure out how long it's been since they raised them. And if it's been 3 or 4 years, they raise them by $5 and they move on. And your tournament may have started as a $50 an entry tournament back in the day, but one of the easy ways to start attracting people is to, lower those fees and bring it down to the level of where things are, rather than being caught in your needs of your budget, which no one cares about when they're deciding what tournaments to come.
Actually, I'd even go one step further and say that I can tell you right now that with the Bronx tournament in the first year, I basically, and I'm not saying that everyone is in a position to do this, but I was very blunt with the team and with the administration of my school. I said, this tournament cannot in any way serve as a fundraiser this year or probably not next year either. In fact, we might have to take a small loss on the tournament. If the goal here is to rebuild this brand, to use Jim's term, we need to really invest in the tournament.
But I have a question. If you rebuild your brand, doesn't that, in fact, motivate your alums?
Absolutely.
Give support.
So yes, that's
fundraising comes in some other way.
Exactly.
I certainly try to raise funds with my tournament, but I think one of the things people have to realize is that a lot of tournaments just aren't going to be fundraisers. And I mean, and if, you know, so first of all, if you want to have a tournament, you may not make any money ever. And the other thing is, if you do want to be as a fundraiser, you really have to invest a lot of money. to make that happen.
You won't make money this year.
Yeah. But even over the, my tournament, I do make money at the tournament, but I'm putting in an awful lot of money in trophies and buying judges and food and all this kind of stuff. So proportionately, considering what goes in, you don't make all that much money, you know?
Right.
The tournaments as fundraisers and conceiving of them as fundraisers is not the world's greatest idea. And I think Chris is right. What happens is people just look at the tournament from last year and keep going. Now, there was a thing a couple of years ago. It was on the NDCA, and somebody posted this, we should just stop raising fees all the time. And this was also when we started doing the MHL workshop, and we should also train people. And I really took that to heart. I mean, why am I raising my fee? Expenses haven't gone up. I mean, my it's all arbitrary. So why am I raising these fees?
And what's funny is this actually points to one of the reasons why I think the speech side at Manchester didn't take off this year, in that the MFL, our local league, on the speech side to a degree, but also our public forum divisions, has charged $5 an entry for its tournaments now. Since I was a competitor, it was $5 an entry then, and it's still $5 an entry now.
It's like our CFL.
And that does two effects. One is it's good for the MFL, and it's great that people, you know, don't have to spend a lot of money to come to our tournaments. But the other side effect is that there's this strong disconnect and disparity between the MFL speech-centric programs and the Northeastern Debating League. Because to some degree in the Northeastern Debating League, Jim charges us $40 and we pay it, and then he turns around and gives it back to us when he comes to Big Lex. And so we're all kind of just moving around the same pot of money. But if you're a program whose fundraiser brings in $5 an entry, you don't have access to the program whose fundraiser brings in $50 an entry. And so one of the failings of the Manchester tournament in particular is that they couldn't attract as much of that speech pool or even some of the PF pool because our local league is on the other side of the wrong side of that barrier. You know what I mean?
But can a tournament that, I mean, Manchester, for people who don't know it, Manchester is fairly isolated.
Sure.
For all of us, it's like at the furthest end of Massachusetts. And even for people who aren't us, it's at the furthest end of Massachusetts. So it takes a long time to get there. So can a tournament that is hard to get to, or at least, it's a 5-hour bus ride. What can they do to attract me to get on a bus for 5 hours? And should they be trying to do that? Or should, in fact, they look to their local area and come up with a tournament for them and just forego trying to have a tournament of the other sort?
To some degree, the PF, I think, is their strength. And PF is their opportunity. Because in Massachusetts, PF is local debate. And it's very strong here. We field routinely at these local tournaments anywhere from 30 to 50 teams from 10 to 15 different schools and have very active and vibrant divisions. And I feel like if you had a tournament like Manchester where all of those schools showed up plus enough regional schools to make a difference, that becomes attractive to Regis and to Bronx and the schools in New York that have their PF teams.
Can you get those local schools to show up?
I mean, you just give them the price discount. Yeah, you charge them $10 or $15 instead of 50. And this is where Cruz's lines about you're not going to make money at first comes in.
Right.
In fact, you have to be willing to take that hit in order to get those schools to even show up.
Next year, I'm sorry, go on.
You had like 20 some odd novice PF teams, right, at one of these MHLs.
We have a huge number of
PF. So, I mean, that would attract you then if you saw
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I mean, we brought our top public forum teams went.
And PF was a much stronger division at Manchester, to be fair.
Yes, so. I do think that
have a strength that they can build on here.
I think there are a couple of things that I would say. The first thing is that next year I'm adding the individual events to my own tournament. So it'll be the first year that we have speech under in the Cruz era, as it were, of Bronx Science. And one of the things that we're going to do is not charge anything actually to the local NYCFL teams. They can come for free in speech. I'm doing this for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons I'm doing it pretty bluntly is to build interest in the tournament, right? I want to make sure that our local schools are represented, and that will help build numbers for the schools that have already committed to bringing in speech.
I know, that's a win-win situation.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know,
and you have good speed. And New York City has very solid contenders in three or four schools there. Yeah, so
absolutely,
that's a good
thing. And so, you know, Charlie Sloat, who's the president of our local league, for speech said, you know, John, you know, you're going to lose money on that. I said, of course, I'm going to lose money on that. I know that. I mean, that's you know, that's okay. That's part of building the tournament. You can't. It's not going to be a a profit enterprise. And frankly, I don't really run my tournament as a profit enterprise to begin with. But even if I were to, you have to build somewhere, right?
Right.
My feeling is that there are a couple of, I guess this would be the cruise check sheet. And I feel like being okay speaking authoritatively on this because I have revived a tournament pretty big time. I mean, we had 24 kids and no bid in LD at Bronx Science when I first started like 6 years ago. Now we have 180 kids in an Octus bid. So I say from experience the following things. The first thing I think is your tournament needs to have a theme. I'll get back to that afterwards, but I actually think in many ways it's the most important thing. The second most important thing is your tournament has to be reasonably priced. A tournament cannot be $5 different than an Octus or a Quarters bid and not provide anything for those $5 difference. I don't think that a tournament's cost has to be based on its TOC bid, because very few tournaments have TOC bids. But they have to be provided, they have to be based on what you're getting at the tournament. Are you getting free meals? Are you getting incredible hospitality? Are your awards beautiful, et cetera? When your tournament is not really, this is no tournament, and this is applicable to many different tournaments that I've been to that I think charge outrageous prices. When you look at your tournament and the awards that you're getting or the hospitality that you're getting is really no different from like a 1 day, 4 round tournament. And perhaps actually the awards are even less attractive than that. There's a problem, and that problem isn't going to go away. And the reason that problem isn't going to go away goes back to a theme I talked about, I think sometime last year, which is for all that people make fun of me in trophies. And I actually just wrote like an article that addresses this in part in the rostrum. For all people like to make jokes about Cruz and his trophies and whatnot, trophies are the most tangible thing that remains from the tournament afterwards. People go to your school and say, wow, that's a beautiful trophy. Where did you win that? Or if you're being successful enough, they go, wow, I know that trophy is from tournament X. Now I want to go to tournament X, right? I mean, that's one of the brilliant things about like the TOC horse trophies. They're not really that attractive, but they're iconic. People know what they are, right?
Well, right. Not only that, but the trophy is also the last thing you get at the tournament.
Right, it's the last impression you have.
And from the point of view of running a tournament, it is the most painful thing to pay for. I pay. Oh my
yes,
God! I go into Irving, the trophy guy. Oh my!
You want really good trophies? They're going to be expensive, but you do want really good trophies because people like.
You want to get distinctive trophies too. I think the idea of the Meadows belt is just hilarious, and everybody immediately knows what it is.
Right. Meadows belts, absolutely. You know, I went for with my own trophies. I went for very themed, sort of. You know, they're big, which I think is important. I also for our first place trophies, I love debate history and whatnot. I did a thing where we would name all the trophies after Bronx Science alumni and whatnot. That clearly has caught on.
You've run out of alumni.
I've started to run out of alumni. That's the real reason we're adding speech, actually, so I can name more trophies. But we, you know, these are things that you can do that are simple. Now, another thing that you have to do. So we talk about theming. We talk about trophies. The price is really, really important. You know, it's painful to cut the price of a tournament, but people notice that you do that and they appreciate it. Yeah. Another thing that you need to do that's important, I think, there are two things that I would recommend as well. These are all broad. I can get into specifics after. Hospitality is extremely important. You don't want to have hungry kids at tournaments. And, you know, that happens at a lot of different events. You can only have hungry kids at tournaments if you have stores that are right outside that you can buy food from. This college tournaments can get away with this because they're in college towns, right? And if you charge...
That's actually an attraction of the college.
Right, yeah, it's
tournament.
An attraction. You can go eat at the restaurants nearby. I think that restaurants in Princeton, for example, are great. Cambridge, those are awesome restaurants. So... You know, that you need to be thinking about hospitality, both for kids and for judges. When you have grumpy judges, then they're grumpy and the kids get grumpy and it's not a good experience.
If anything, more for judges, because the people in the judges' lounge are the ones making the decision as to which tournaments to go to next year.
That's very true. That's very true. And then I guess the last thing is there are a lot of costs in tournaments that are not reflected in the direct fees. So in other words, you've got these higher judge fees. So we know that your higher judge fees are theoretically going to hiring judges. And we know you got the entry fees and those are going to cover X, Y, and Z. But then you kind of have to think about how am I paying for am I going to pay judge transportation? I think that, you know, not all tournaments have to do that, but maybe when they're revitalizing themselves, they want to spend a little extra money on getting those judges out there and paying for the judges' transportation to get there, especially when you're in a more isolated area. Right. So these are kinds of things that broadly speaking, and I know we'll get into more specifics after, but broadly speaking, need to be on the tournament agenda. But I just want to say one last thing. I'm sorry that I'm talking for so long about this, but this is a subject I feel really strongly about. I think it's the first and foremost thing, and I actually know we said this directly last year when we talked about how to run a tournament, is the first question a director needs to ask himself or herself is, why am I running this tournament? Am I running this tournament purely as a fundraiser? Am I running this tournament because, and this is what I said to my own kids, I said, you know, Bronx Science, we're a huge team. We go to more tournaments than basically any other team in the country. So we have like a moral obligation to run an awesome tournament. Like we give up, take a lot from the community, so we have to give a lot to the community. You have to ask yourself a question like that. And it sounds corny, but I actually think it shapes everything else, because then you start to ask yourself, why am I running the tournament? What's the niche of my tournament? What's the brand, et cetera, et cetera? That's the most important question. Beats is being very silent. He hates this topic. He's not even there. Look at that. Oh, I'm just kidding. No, Beats, I actually, you know, Beats has done a phenomenal job building tournaments as well, which is why I think that we're particularly lucky that he's part of this conversation. He's built tournaments basically from the ground up, right?
I think that more important than, I mean, if you want a national tournament, you have to catch lightning in a bottle. I mean, the tournaments, I mean, if you look at the rise and fall of tournaments, it's almost directly correlated with the rise and fall of the quality of the debaters coming out of that region. The South used to have Vestavia, Homewood, St. James used to all be huge bid tournaments, and then as the region sort of fell apart in terms of national success at the TOC, so too did the bids. And those two are probably intertwined in that when you start moving bid levels down because the quality isn't as good, then fewer kids go, which means the quality stays down. So it's sort of... It probably reinforces itself. If you look at the Midwest and you look at the rise of the Minneapolis and the Blake tournament and back the Valley tournament, all those rose as the quality of debaters and the success of the debaters rose as well. And same thing with Dallas and et cetera. So sure. I think that there's a lot to do with when you have the talent in your area, capturing that, because people are going to want to come and debate where the good debaters are. And because when you have a lot of talent in the area, you can convince the TOC to give you more bids.
Right, sure.
The exception is, you know, some of the big tournaments like Harvard and Berkeley, who, you know, regardless of the quality of competition, seems like they'll just get TOC bids. In terms of building a tournament, I guess it just depends what you want. I run two tournaments. I run the Harvard Westlake tournament, which I guess I never see as being a big tournament. I want it to be more for local kids to come to and have an opportunity at two and maybe someday four bids. And then the VBT is something completely different. And the way the VBT was built is Southern California has no long tradition of successful debaters. At least in Lincoln Douglas, and policy debate it definitely does, but in Lincoln Douglas debate it just doesn't. So it was started to try to bring national debaters to Southern California, and we knew that people would have to get on a plane, so we made it worth their while by having a round robin to try to get better kids to come, and oftentimes subsidizing their flights and their hotel rooms and their entry fees.
Subsidies are important.
Flying out judges so that, it just so happened that a generation of very successful debaters also became very friendly with Victory Briefs. So we flew out a lot of those judges paid for them to come out and have a good time and judge. And typically I found that you don't even have to pay those people if you're paying for them and they're having a good time and they get to hang out with their friends. But, you know, we pay for their flight and their hotel room and all their meals. So they got to spend, you know, winter in Southern California. Sure. So I guess, you know, I don't know if there's any big secret to building a big tournament. A lot of it is luck in terms of, are you in a region that's going to get a lot of good debaters to go there? And then once your luck runs out about having good debaters, how do you keep people coming back?
Right.
Even when the good debaters disappear.
But I think we need to...
I want to just jump in something, because Beats saying that they're... I actually agree with everything Beats is saying with the regions, but there is one thing that sort of like hidden in what Beats was saying. That's very important, and because Beats is running two very different kinds of tournaments, and I think that this goes back to what I was saying about thinking about what kind of tournament you want. Not everyone has to have the big national tournament.
That's what I was going to say.
And I think that that's an error that, you know, I understand why that happens, but not everybody has to have that tournament. Some of my favorite tournaments are very local and regional tournaments. And same thing with my kids, right? You can have a great experience at a smaller tournament or a regional tournament. I think that that's something that that should be noted. But anyway,
well,
Jim,
and the other angle of that too, though, is that regional does not necessarily mean smaller either.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the great comparison this past year is Yale, which is, you know, a national draw tournament with a quarters bid, and Princeton, which is a much more regional local draws tournament with a finals bid. They each had 160 debaters in the LD field. And,
actually, I think Princeton was even larger than that, right?
It's possible.
Princeton, I think, was actually bigger than Yale in terms of numbers.
It could have been like on the margin. Yeah. It could have been like 10 or 12 more. But sure. The target number for both was 160. And they both had equal large numbers of debaters. And sure, the average debater at Yale was probably a little better than the average debater at Princeton. But at the end of the day, if you're running a good show and you're running a tournament, you don't really care too much necessarily how good the debaters are at your tournament. The other thing that is interesting too is that a lot of tournaments, I feel the way they slide down and the reason they start to slide is because they rest on that bid level as their crutch. And if you took a tournament, a tournament in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska, and blessed it all of a sudden with an Octos bid, sure, some people would go to it that hadn't gone before. But at the same time, an Octos bid or a quarters bid is not a guarantee of a good tournament. And nor does it necessarily signify a bad tournament when a tournament doesn't have an Octos bid or a quarters bid or whatever. Because, you know, I don't know of a single program in the country that can say that it goes to every single Octos and quarters bid tournament out there. You know, we're all making choices, and it's not like that's automatic necessarily.
Man, don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah.
The most tournaments that exist have no bids whatsoever.
Right.
So, I mean, those are the ones that, I mean, most people should be thinking of putting together. I mean, putting together, you know, a bid tournament is a mug's game because you have no control over whether you're going to get the bid no matter how many people show up. So putting together a tournament that is popular with a group that you can target, you can't target the TOC committee, you know, because that's the only group that you'd be targeting if that's your goal. What you want to do is target the people that are going to come to your tournament and offer them stuff that makes them want to come to the tournament. So like we said, like you just said, Chris, the college tournaments have natural attractions. People want to go to those places. So if you run a good tournament, people have fun, and it's not so much about the, you know, so, you know, Princeton, you know, it's a good example of a tournament that's not so much about the competition. There's plenty of good people there, and it's worth whatever bid it had. I don't know what it is, but anyhow, it's worth all of that. Finals is definitely worth it. But people are going there because it's a, you know, we run a nice tournament. It's fun to go to Princeton. It's a very attractive school. You know, it's another Ivy that people get to roam around. The town is fun. Everybody has a good time. You know, so having a tournament where everybody has a good time has to be whatever, however that good time is had. And like Beat says, having all the judges come and seeing each other and having a good time, that's going to be good for the atmosphere of the tournament. Because if the judges are having fun, that's a real step in the right direction.
Yeah, you know?
And if the judges are not having fun, that tournament is down the toilet. It's just not going to survive because the judges set the tone. Tournament director set the tone too, but certainly the judges are very important.
Yeah, actually, the tournament director setting the tone is very important. You know, one of the things I tell my own debaters, and I think that a lot of tournaments that are in revival mode could do the same. One of the most important things you need to tell the kids who are running the tournament with you, you know, your runners, your bout table, et cetera, is the way that the tournament treats its guests is the make or break as far as I'm concerned. I mean, at the end of the day, people are going to be willing to, if you run a terrible tournament, people are going to be willing to give you another chance if you treat the guests in a way that they feel they deserve to be treated. So one thing that's important is that some tournaments, when they start to spiral, you know, out of control and whatnot, make it very obvious that they're spiraling out of control, right? The tournament director looks frantic. The kids are, you know, milling about and can't be found. No, there are no runners anywhere. The parents are being rude to the kids, or to, you know, the parents are serving the food or being rude, or they're not giving you food at all. Things like that. It's very important to treat people like guests at your event, right? I feel like that's actually quite important.
And that really does come down to the tournament director too,
yes.
Because I, you know, for the first time this year at Yale, we have always had trouble at Yale because the freshmen on the Yale debate team have been there 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever. And there wasn't a very good sense of uniform purpose among the YDA. And the students who ran the tournament were always very on the ball. But the students who are members of the Yale debate team who weren't necessarily connected to the tournament directly, other than the fact that they were helping out that weekend, tended to be very uneven in how helpful they were. So this year, for the first time, I went down and we had a meeting of the entire YDA, and I just laid out to them what the expectations were. Here mm-hmm. is how you deal with this situation. Here is the attitude you need to adopt.
Yep.
Here are the things that you're not allowed to say or do, no matter what. And it made the world of difference. I didn't have a single whiny Yale-y talk about the paper they had to do or anything of that sort. And it really made it for a much pleasant weekend. So having that meeting with your parents or with your student yep. runners or whoever is absolutely critical.
Yeah, no, I strongly agree with that. And, you know, I keep talking about my own tournament only because, you know, I run my own tournament. But one of the nicest compliments that was given to me was given to me by several people who said that the atmosphere at my tournament this year was just nice. It was just a friendly atmosphere. People felt very welcome. More so than perhaps they do it at tournaments of similar drawn size where there's a naturally ultra competitive, you know, cutthroat kind of feel to, you know, and that happens at very large high stakes tournaments. So I was glad to know that just, you know, while we have an octave bid and whatnot, that what people really were pleased with was the atmosphere of the tournament. That's so important.
But I mean, I agree with that, but, I mean, I do go with that whole, I mean, there's two things, and I just want to emphasize that. I mean, the tournament directors themselves, I've had tournament direct. I mean, I remember one tournament in particular, and I won't name it, where we went there, and I really felt like they didn't want us there. They didn't want anybody there. And they were really unpleasant to, you know, every time you asked a question of somebody, or even when during the award ceremony, when there were announcements or assemblies, whatever, I mean, it was just unpleasant. And of course, I never went back. And the tournament doesn't exist anymore, not because I didn't go back, but I'm, you know, self-destructed. And the other thing is the kids themselves. I mean, the kids have to be helpful. And you're right, guests. It's like the Disney.
Yes, that is actually a good comparison. Yeah.
Well, they're called guests. If you go to Disney, you're not a customer. You're not a visitor. You're a guest. And you treat people like a guest. And, like, you know, having your ballot tables, I mean, one of my things that I always say is a ballot table, you don't eat, you don't play with your computer, you don't do nothing. You just sit there like an idiot and answer questions nicely. That's your job, not to be just, you know, I'm sorry, I can't really help you now because, you know, I'm in the middle of Civ 3 or whatever. You know, so you have to be, you know, the concierge. I mean, the ballots nowadays take care of themselves. You know, we print
yes.
all the ballots and they come back. We don't have to check them off on a schematic or anything like that. So all the kids out there have to do is make sure they find the judges that need to be found and they're polite to people. Very easy thing to do, but I would say half the tournaments I go to, it's not true. Half the tournaments I go to, that table is just cluttered with kids hanging out from mm-hmm. the school, and they're blocking the ballots, and they're all on their computers, and they're all and the other thing that just drives me crazy is bringing in food from outside.
Yes.
You know, if the yes. food is so bad at this tournament that the kids have to go out and get other food, there is a problem. So.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to what I'm saying about the difference between a tournament and an event. You know, a tournament, you can find a tournament anywhere and just go to tournaments, right? But if you really want people to, and it doesn't matter if it's a national event or a regional event or whatever, but if you want like a loyal following of your tournament, it has to transcend its state as a tournament. I mean its existence as a tournament. I mean that really seriously. Like there needs to be something special about your tournament. And it doesn't have to be that all the awards are named after an alumni at your school. It could just be the atmosphere of the tournament. But I do think, you know, having special things at your tournament are very important. That's part of the initial brainstorming that you have to have about your event.
Well, it should be a place where, like, alums of your program want to come back.
Yes.
You know, it should be the weekend of the year where people who may be retired debate coaches who live in the local area say, huh, it's the tournament this weekend. Maybe I should go and say hi to my friends. I haven't seen them.
I agree.
You know, like that's, you want it to be a place where people associate fond memories.
Emphasize that. I mean, I used to go to the Newark tournament. I still go to the Newark tournament. You go to the Newark tournament and all their alums were always back judging rounds, especially on the Saturday, because a lot of them worked and stuff like that. And it was such a good feeling to go into rounds that everybody judging that round was an ex-Newark person. And they'd all come back.
Right.
And you said that sense of community that that tournament built spread to the people who weren't part of that community. It just feels good. It feels good to see all those people like that.
And I do think a lot of that comes
directly on the East Coast than it is anywhere else.
That's fair. That's fair. And I think that all of this comes with a caveat of if it's doable. That's totally true. I mean, it's not only is it easier on the East Coast than the West Coast. I bet it's easier on both the East Coast and the West Coast than it is in some of the middle parts of the country where a lot of people move away. I mean, I Beats's point is totally correct.
But as sort of a lodestone, whether or not it's doable, it works very well because it's, you want to throw the event that people would want to, even
right.
if they
That's
can't,
true.
You know,
That's true.
And so it's not a bad thing to keep in the back of your mind, even if you live in, you know, Western Kreplakistan and no alum ever will return.
Right.
And the other thing I'd sort of wanted to emphasize about that is that it's very easy to do. A tournament director can really set the tone because their parents, you know, your parent hosts who may be crabby or whatever are probably crabby because they don't know what they're doing and they don't feel like they're appreciated. And the student runners who aren't running aren't being told to run. And it doesn't take much of a pep talk on the part of the tournament director to make the parents happy and make the students terrified so that they both do what they're supposed to do.
Or vice versa, either one.
Yeah, you know, whatever works for you, however you run your program.
Yeah, but I mean, these are all important. I think very important things.
There's one thing. Okay, we know that talking about the nature of the tournament and the brand of the tournament. I mean, brand in terms of some of the things we're talking about that are extraneous to the actual competition, like, you know, trophies and stuff. I mean, I certainly have a brand of crappy trophies or crappy prizes that I give out.
But you also have nice acrylic awards.
I have nice regular awards, but I also have specific.
They're acrylic.
I have crappy prizes. We have a tradition of crappy prizes.
That's true.
And the crappiest prize of all is the first prize. You know, so
yes.
I'd work hard deciding.
To get those crappy prizes. Again. That's true. You
know, which I will admit is a very shrewd branding for somebody who's a cheapskate.
You know, it just works.
If you can get there first, it works. But you just can't. You have to do it first.
Yeah, you have to be the first one. Everybody else comes out with crappy. You know, John next year gives out crappy prizes. People go, why? I paid $100 for it. And, but I mean, then what it is that you're offering at the tournament has to become another question. So going back to Manchester, I mean, Manchester has a history of policy and as a starting point for its debaters. All their novices used to do policy, or their freshmen used to do policy, and then they would switch over in their second year and do LD. And they built a very strong LD program. But, you know, I mean, the virtues or lack thereof of that notwithstanding, I think it worked. And, you know, because you would teach people basic debate and then specialize them in this one kind of debate. I mean, it was fine. I mean, however it was done. But anyhow, they had a good history and they always had people, you know, traveling around and winning prizes and going to TOC and so forth and so on. So the program was very strong as an LD program. Now, over the years, I mean, this was under different management. Okay, this was Tim Averill, and they're on, like, their fourth coach since then. You know, all of them having been nice people. I like all these people, so it's not any comment on the people. But the nature of what the school is doing itself has changed. So when Jonathan Peel was there, it was absolutely, he's a PF guy. You know,
sure.
So he's concentrating
on very good, and a very good PF.
Yeah. So we have a shift in what the school is doing. So the question becomes, I mean, should, yeah, all right. So they're no longer getting the TOC bids for whatever reason. It doesn't matter. So they don't have the TOC bids anymore. I mean, so my question was, and this is what I had talked to Bill Cooper, who's the you know, Honcho there now trying to do, which is build it up as primarily a PF tournament. So mm-hmm. does this kind of shift work? I mean, I don't know.
Is absolutely. I want to say two things about that. I think first off, a lot of tournaments have a problem with overreach. What do I mean by overreach? I mean, offering every single event. That's just not necessary. Unless you have a reason to believe you're going to reach critical mass in every single one of those events. Now, I believe had I had speech this year, I could have reached critical mass in it. Now, Jim, actually, when I talked to him about it over the summer, was slightly opposed to me having speech.
And no, I was violently opposed.
That's actually true. Okay, fine. Violently opposed. Good point.
It just seemed like a lot to do this year. Year seemed like a lot to do.
And that's fair.
And I think what happened by not doing it, that's why you had such a great tournament, because it was just capitalizing on where you were.
Absolutely.
And then letting it go.
I think
next year is a good idea.
Sure. And I agree completely with Jim. I mean, while I still feel we would have had a very good speech tournament, I think that next year we can have a great speech tournament, because I think that we have everything else. You know, I'm very proud of how everything else the tournament is running, and I'm willing to make tweaks and whatnot, which is actually something that we'll talk about in a moment. But I do believe that a tournament cannot reinvent itself completely in every aspect overnight. So it's a matter of adding things. So if we retrace my own tournament in the first year, I mean, a lot of the early concentration I had was in LD. And part of the reason for that was I myself came from the LD community. I knew that I had the most connections that I could make in LD, and I could draw on those connections, bring in the judges, et cetera. And then I started turning it to build on the other events. Different layers of my tournament did not all come at once. Like, you know, I have the Bronx Achievement Awards. Yes, I did those in the first year, but, you know, recognizing alumni and that kind of stuff came a little later. Having, certain aspects of the tournament are added as I become confident in the strength of the existing parts. So I don't believe that a tournament can completely recreate itself overnight in every event.
One step at a time.
Right,
one
exactly. And then this sort of connects to something that I think is really important of a tournament that's reinventing itself is honesty. And what do I mean by that? Honesty is saying we don't have the top tournament right now. What can we do to make it better? Now, the best way to do this is to survey people. I really believe that. And I believe that tournaments should actually have post-tournament surveys even when they're doing a good job. I do believe that. I solicited feedback after this year and got mostly very positive responses, a couple of constructive things, and some suggestions I hadn't actually thought about. I also think that honesty means at the very end of the tournament communicating with people. And this is not really meant to – you know, most people don't do this. But I do think that if you know there was something that could have been done better at your tournament – preempting everyone and acknowledging it immediately is a good thing. So for example, at my own tournament this year, overall, I think that the panels in our first elimination round, the Sexto Decimos, were pretty good, but I think they could have been better had we double flighted them. I do think that. And so I knew that people were going to suggest that, and I myself thought that. So before anyone did suggest it, I sent out an email that night, said, here are the results, et cetera. Here are some changes we're going to make next year, X, Y, and Z. Same thing with our public forum schedule. You know, our public forum tournament has outgrown its schedule. In other words, our schedule was designed for a very local public forum tournament. We now have a much larger PF tournament with very serious teams that really are going to take time between each round, and I respect that. So we're going to expand the schedule a little bit. Things like that I think are good. Acknowledging what you're going to change immediately makes people realize that you take your tournament so seriously that you're already thinking about the next installment. And look, I love running the New York City Invitational, but at the same time, I also love going to sleep after it's done because it's the most satisfying feeling in the world. But taking care of that very quickly thereafter is a good tone setter, and I especially think it's a good tone setter when you're still in the rebuilding phase. I think that if you tell people that you're being that serious about your tournament and you're soliciting feedback and you're telling them what you're going to do differently, they respect that big time. And all too often tournaments that are rebuilding themselves, I don't hear a word from them afterwards. And then the rebuilding doesn't go as quickly as they'd like or doesn't go at all because they're not really finding out what people need to have at their tournament. I suspect that a lot of people would love, I mean, it just makes sense that Manchester would be a major PF tournament in our region. I mean, Tim Averill was a founding figure of public forum debate. The team is a very, you know, has PF is a young event, but it already has a strong tradition of excellence. And I mean, they closed out the TOC. There's, you know, this is a tournament that makes sense to be a PF-centered event. And that's okay to be centered in that in that particular event.
And they're a local region that can supply a good PF field that would attract other schools from outside the region.
Exactly.
I mean, if we had the full Massachusetts crew there, there'd be 50, 60 teams, all of which would be attractive to the New York schools to compete against.
Yeah, I mean, I know the New York schools because, I mean, we'd run them at the local tournaments, and their younger kids especially have to spend a lot of time debating each other because, you know, they go to invitationals and there's only so many slots. I have a tournament coming up in a couple of weeks, and it's like five or six slots to each school. And, you know, I mean, like a school like Regis probably has about, you know, 40 teams.
And then Mr. Menick has to put up with a coach like me begging for more and more slots whenever possible.
And you notice that no matter how often
you would
never
do that, Mr. Cruz. I can't believe that you would do that.
Well, look, these are all very important considerations. I think that honesty is the most central thing. Honesty with yourself about why you're running your tournament. Honesty with what you can do better next year. Honesty with saying, and it sounds very Stuart Smalley of me, I apologize, but, you know, being able to say, look, I can't do it all at once. So what can I do and what steps am I going to do them in? And if my goal is to have this massive, amazing event, how many years do I have to plan out or how many steps do I have to take to make it happen? Here's some other just random asides that I would say.
Well, I like honesty a lot because there's also a very strong value in saying, yes, this tournament has sucked before to people, you know, because if your tournament sucks for whatever reason, and you don't even have to agree that it sucks, but if people stop coming, they think it does. And if your tournament has sucked a lot, just simply saying that to people who have attended before is enough to undercut some of that. I have sworn I'm never coming back to this tournament again.
I think, you know, that worked on those college tournaments.
It was the college tournaments. I know it worked with my tournament because I said that to people. I said, I know, you know, this is a new director. This is especially important, I think, when you are a new coach at a pre-existing program. Super important. Super important.
Yeah, nothing is to be gained by saying, oh, what, it's all wonderful and sunshine and roses when it's not. Yep. So
I just want to say a couple of very quick random things. You know, I mentioned the trophies before. I do think it's important that trophies be iconic or seem to be reflective of the money that you're paying. And I always think you should estimate up on that. So even if you're not charging that much, you really do want to spend a lot of money on awards. It's the last thing the kid gets at the tournament. It's the lasting impression of your tournament all year. Some tournaments do this with T-shirts and whatnot. I think that makes sense too. You know, have something that's permanent. I don't do T-shirts at my tournament, but I see a reason for having it as free advertising, particularly when kids go to camp or, you know, on their own team, they see the shirts. There's a reason to see T-shirts. I think that having something unique at your tournament is good. So something unique can be the crappy prizes at Bump. They can be the Lexington Coaching Award. They could be the Emory Keys. They could be the Director's Chair at VBT. They could be the Bronx Achievement Awards. They could be the Word Sexto Decimos. They could be, you know, calling it
not that, anything but that.
Now, I mean that seriously. You know, things that people know. Yeah, well, funny. But I mean, it's something that makes your tournament unique and that sticks out in people's minds. Because right now, if you're the kind of tournament we're talking about, what sticks out in people's minds is, wow, that tournament used to be good, now it's not, or wow, that tournament sucks, or whoa, no one went to that event, right? That's not what you want people to be thinking about. Instead, what you want people to be thinking about is, who is going to win the Lexington Coaching Award this year? Or wow, let me look at the past list of recipients, something I want to talk about in a moment, and who won that? Wow, that's cool. Now, again, I love debate history, so I have a bias, but if your tournament has a history of excellence and it's fallen into disrepair, connecting to that history of excellence is very important, even if you're going to do things differently. So to use my own tournament as an example really quickly, like there was a period where the Bronx Science tournament was really excellent. There's a period where it wasn't. And hopefully people think that it's a very strong tournament again. I think that connecting the eras, doing a little research, finding out who won the tournament, really important. The Kaiser does this very well at Monticello. Not a very large tournament, but there's a full sense of the history of the event. You feel like you're part of something larger than yourself. I think that's a good way to advertise the history of the tournament, but also a good way to make the tournament feel, again, like an event, something that's big. That's why I love traveling trophies and things like that, because you feel, you know, that shows that there's a legacy at the tournament. And the traveling trophy can be the Richard B. Sadako, where it'd be this massive, you know, wooden edifice, or it could be the traveling fruit cup at Bump, which is like the most fun an irreverent award, but an award that I covet more than anything else as a coach, frankly. I love the Fruit Cup. So how does that
Boy, with a softball like that down the plate, how can it not?
What can you say? Just let it go.
Shut up. Anyway, I think that's important. Also, one last thing that's a random aside, but really important. You know, the tournament exists even when the tournament isn't running. So in other words, like when the tournament is done and you've sent out the email of what you're going to do better and thanking people for coming, thank the kids who are running it and the parents who are running it. They need to feel like they're invested in the tournament as well. I'm really lucky. Matt Dene's mom, even though Matt Dene graduated, he does coach our team and whatnot, but his mom doesn't need to come around and run the judges lounge for us or do hospitality, but she does because she really enjoys it. It's her chance to see friends as well. And it's her chance to feel like she's continuing to contribute to something she's proud of. I mean, I like the fact that when JW comes to my tournament, he looks for Matt's mom to say hi. I think that's pretty cool, right? And I think that's, even if you don't have the director of the TOC coming to your tournament, having people want to come back to your tournament is important. So, you know, Beach was right about how difficult it is in some areas to have alumni come back. But I know a number of tournaments where parents do come back in the region, their parents that haven't left. That's something that you can also aim for. And I think makes people feel like they're, you know, feel happy. Also allows that you to have people who know what they're doing come back year after year, which is really important.
We are running out of time.
Can I add some things?
Certainly. Well, you're still here. Okay, good. Yes, do.
Before, the thing that people complain most about, I think, is when a tournament doesn't run on time,
yep,
or when the judging is bad, or when it seems to have an incompetent taproom staff, or they're doing, you know, that just what they're doing doesn't make sense to them. When I think of a tournament that just sort of did a solid job of always, you know, just doing what it needs to do to be, and never advertised itself and never tried to do any of the things that have been talked about, at least not, you know, open, not publicly, nationally, is a mm-hmm. tournament like Scarsdale, yep, or yep, College Prep, or, you know, just tournaments that do a good, that seem to do a good job of just running a tournament that everyone's just enjoying. I mean,
and
what leads to the most enjoyment is rounds that start on time and have good judges, and those would be where I would say that if a tournament wanted to rebuild, those are the questions that people are going to ask. Are, you know, what's your schedule, and do you have good judges? Because, I mean, for, like, I love the Bronx tournament, and we're always going to go back, but if anyone said anything negative, it was going to be because they thought the Sexto, well, I don't even know what
they
that those panels weren't as good, right? Mm-hmm. It's stuff like that people remember. And it's the knock on the Harvard tournament or the Berkeley tournament or any other some tournaments that used to be great. If the judging starts falling off, people stop going. And I think that that's if you want to start attracting top national debaters where there's an expectation of a certain type of judge. I mean, even at St. Mark's this year. Right. The big complaint was that it didn't run on time and that the judges weren't there. And St. Mark's is a huge tradition. It has awesome trophies. It has, you know, it keeps a pretty good history. It does all these things. But when the tournament doesn't run on time when the judging is bad, people remember that. When the stakes are high, if we're talking about TOC bids, if the stakes are high and people have paid a lot of money to go for it, at a very minimum, that's what we want. I mean, the VBT, you know, we don't even do an award ceremony. I post the top 10 speakers on the wall and say, come get your trophy in the tap room. I mean, we don't do any of the pomp and circumstance.
Sure.
None of that stuff. But, you know, I spent a lot of money to fly in a tab staff that has no one affiliated with the tournament. And is a strong tab staff. We pay people to keep the tournament running on time. We don't use kids to do that. We use adults and pay them to check in ballots and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, we have a feeling that might be more sterile than some tournaments, but we get it done quickly, and we fit a lot of rounds in a short amount of time, and we have good judges. So, you know, to people that are sort of, where do you want to start? I would say start with having if you have some extra budget money, certainly get trophies and things like that, but hire good judges to come, and so that people feel like they that what they're saying matters, and that, that how they're debating matters. And then once the good judging comes, then word gets around, oh, this tournament has good judges, and more people might come. And then you have a little more money that you can play with to spend on other things. But good judges, staying on time, those would be the two things that, you know, that it seems like a lot of invitationals in California have just forgotten about doing, and don't care anymore about that kind of stuff. But, you know, that I think is what's going to keep people coming back, absent the other stuff.
Well, I would point out that when John started rebuilding the Bronx, the first thing was he went broke bringing in judges. You know, he spent a lot of money doing that.
And they're very much tied together in that if you have a good solid pool of neutral judges, a lot of tapping, particularly in the later elims, becomes a lot easier.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 90% the good judges are going to go to their aids. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, and just simply having them there so you don't have to be scraping at the bottom of the barrel and begging from other divisions or doing all of the other
things. You can only tab with what you have. You know?
Yeah.
So even as we were doing, I mean, talk about the Bronx and the double flighted round, even as we're doing it, we pretty much decided next year we weren't going to do it, that next year we would double flight it, you know, so I mean, you're sort of locked in sometimes to what you're doing, but you could see that it'd be better if we hadn't done that.
You know, I agree completely.
And sometimes you can't change in the middle of what you're doing.
Right.
You can certainly, like you say, you change it for next year. Everybody knows you will. So there's no bad taste. Everybody's like, okay, that's okay, good. You're going to change it next year. That's good.
By the way, no tournament is perfect, right? So any tournament can improve on something. And that's why I think it's what often happens with tournaments, and I'm not going to name any names, but what often happens with tournaments is that tournaments start to get cocky. And because they know that there's a tradition that there'll be good judging, they get a little lazy with the hiring the judges. So they know that, you know, they think that they're above criticism, so they stop, you know, trying to fix things at the tournament. I think that's a problem. I think Beats is totally right about the importance of staying on time and getting the judges. A tournament really needs to proactively spend money on judges, not just the numerical minimum that is needed to run the tournament. That's a mistake. Right. And this is actually where alumni support is important, because a lot of tournaments do pay their alumni, but not all tournaments do that. And if you run a tight enough ship that people feel loyal to, some tournaments you can rely on people's assistance a little bit. I think that those are very important things. So Beats is totally correct. If it sounds like I'm not saying that your tournament needs to run on time or your judging is important, I didn't mean to say that. I think that Beats is totally right.
And also, given the choice between the two, I would actually pick running on time. Like if you're somehow need to concentrate on only one thing or another, and you're interested in running a tournament at all, I would get what judges you can and then run the damn thing on time and make sure the tap staff has everything they need to. Because as long as the weekend goes forward and is pleasant, it can grow from that. But you can have the best judging panel in the world, but if everybody's debating at 2 a.m., that's what they're going to
do. That's true. I think that's especially true if you're a little more geographically isolated.
I have to throw this in. If you are setting up a tournament, you set up a ratio of 1-3 in your judges, if you're going to do the flight, not 1-4, and you only sell the judges that you actually have extra. A lot of people will do the math and say, well, look, I really only need 1-2, so I'm going to sell this arithmetic to people. And the next thing you know, you don't have enough judges to run, literally don't have enough judges to run the tournament. I have been in that situation, especially when people were running with a 1-4 ratio, and then somebody would be like, bring three people. And a couple of people would say, oh, good, that means I have an extra judge. Well, you don't have an extra judge. It doesn't work out that way. You have to have extra judges, and you have to have a 1-3 ratio in a double flighted round. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. You have to keep that in mind.
No, I agree completely. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course, if as a caveat to that, if Jim Menick is running your tournament, he will occasionally accuse you of not having a 1-3 ratio when in fact you have better than one. Not to name any names.
Well, then, this is because I don't understand your crappy software.
Well, you use my crappy software, so it can't be that bad.
Well, I've only used it a few hundred times, so I'm not used to it yet. It took me a while to figure out. There's this one column for people don't know what we're talking about.
You only have 65 judges at Yale. Oh, my God. I'm like, well, we're only going to have 40 debates at Yale. What's your problem?
Oh, wait. There's something I wanted to say about to add on to what Beats said. is word of mouth is very important, and that's part of what I think Beats is getting at, right? That, like, if you start with those things, the people will know that your tournament was good. So I think that even before the tournament happens, you need to be proactive in telling people that you're doing these things. If people don't know that they're, if not enough people experience it, you're not really going to get positive momentum and word of mouth. I think there's nothing, it is shameless, but you should feel comfortable posting online saying or emailing colleagues in the area are telling them at tournaments, look, the following judges will be at the tournament, or the following people will be running the tab room, or the following this, or the following that. Those are very important things, I think. Getting the word out there is important.
Okay, well, we've gotten the word out. Oh, it's been an hour. So we're going to shut down. One thing I just wanted, next time, I just want to mention this.
See, we're talking about how we're going to improve next time.
Next time, read Brian Manuel's article about the TOC. In
that was interesting. Yeah,
that's an interesting thing. I'd like to talk about that next.
Yeah, that's a good topic for the next one. I like that.
Okay. So anyhow, gentlemen, it's been swell. And next time we'll try to get Beats from monopolizing the entire conversation.
All of Beats' points were great.
I know. We've been saving them for the end. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Night.
Good night.
Okay. Is the recording stopped?
Now it has.